This week, we'll be joined by AFGE Housing and Urban Development Council 222 President Eddie Eiches, who will take us behind the scenes in negotiations with management to reduce furlough days. And later, former Clinton White House spokesman Bob Weiner will discuss the long-term consequences of sequestration. We'll also take you to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, for AFGE's recent protest against federal employee furloughs. But first, we've been joined by Wisconsin State Senator Lena Taylor. Senator, welcome to the program.
It's so nice of you to have me.
You were here today. You're joining us from AFGE's Human Rights Training Conference, but you gave the keynote speech to the closing session of our Young Workers Summit. Tell me about what you said to the crowd.
I reminded them that they don't come to the circumstance that they're in today just by chance. They didn't just roll up on these nice jobs with benefits and, you know, pensions, and more than anything with the kind of balance so they could have family, just by chance. There were individuals years ago in unions, that all types of unions that started as our forefathers, who wanted something better for them and for their families. And I reminded them that that came with a sacrifice. It came at a cost, at a price, and that they lived the American dream because somebody else paid the price for them to live the dream that they live today. And that they are the parents, so to say, of the dream of the next generation and what that would look like.
Of course, AFGE's Young Summit is geared toward workers under the age of 40 who really will be taking the reins, if you will, of the union, of the labor movement, and moving it into its next phase in years to come. How important is it, and how much of your message to them dealt with getting involved, with taking action?
That was one of the keys. You know, one of my favorite quotes is Gandhi's quote, "We must be the change that we want to see in the world." And what I said to them is that they aren't allowed to be on the sidelines. They aren't allowed to say, "Oh, I'm too busy," or, "Oh, it might be too much." We have to be the ones to make sure that the very benefits that we have, the very things that we're reaping as our American dream, that it's made available for the next generation. And I tell them that if we don't stand up, if we don't fight for that, then that really means that access to the 98% may not be possible.
Before the interview, you and I talked, and you indicated to me that you come from a union household. You have a background in the labor movement. Talk to me about how important that was for you in shaping the person that you've become today.
Well, you know, I happen to be the 1,000th senator in my state, the 20th woman to be sworn in to be a state senator, the 5th only African-American in the history of our state, and the 2nd African-American woman. I don't say that to offend anyone. I say that because I stand on the shoulders of people who came before me. It truly is an honor. And I have those opportunities because my dad worked a job that wasn't the best conditions. It was hot being a welder in a plant that was just full of a whole bunch of heat and folks welding. But he worked that job so that he could send his kids to college, so that he could make sure that we got the quality education we needed, so that we could, you know, have the things in life that he had to work harder for, that I think that came to us a little differently. I wouldn't be sitting in front of you today if it was not for the fact that he had that good paying union job that gave him the opportunity to have a weekend to take me go-kart riding, and more importantly, to have the kind of wage that allowed him to give his family the kind of lifestyle. And so the only thing that I think I can say is, for me, when in my state we had an opportunity to either sit on the sidelines and watch our governor take away the ability to sit at a table and talk to your employer and talk about your differences about pay and benefits, that I couldn't sit on the sidelines. So for me, it's been a key, not only in my ability to be that, all those things that I just described, the senator, the lawyer, blah, 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 but also to be the voice when things are not right. And so in the room today, I said to people, other individuals sacrificed for us to have these moments, this moment that we live to live the American dream and have nice things. But if we want the generations behind us to be able to have access to something other than the have and the have-nots. It's our responsibility to be a voice and to stand up and fight back.
Of course, your state in Wisconsin was the focus of some key battles in the last couple of years as it relates to the rights of public workers. Talk to me about that fight and where things really stand today.
The fight started on a Friday. We heard about a bill. It was a 144-page bill. We didn't see the bill until Monday. We heard about the bill from the media. We saw the bill on Monday. Tuesday, we were in Finance Committee, and Wednesday, and then it's history. You saw all of that, denying individuals access to petition their government. And more importantly, you saw a bill that had more than just the destruction of democracy in the workplace, better known as collective bargaining, but many other pieces were in there. And we decided that we were going to fight in every way we could. And so we fought in committee, and when it got to the point that the only option we had was to deny quorum to prevent the bill from going forward at that moment, to slow it down so people would know what was going on, we did it. We were gone 3 weeks. I jokingly say that I rode with one of my colleagues and that men don't know directions is what the rumor is. I didn't believe that stereotype until I got in the car with one of my colleagues and didn't make it to Rockford, where we were supposed to be going. We were gone 3 weeks, and during that time, a movement got started that was much larger than any of us, larger than Wisconsin, for people to know that these kinds of efforts to take away the ability to really talk with your employer about those kinds of issues was coming to a state and a place near you. And after that, we tried to recall our governor. People were very principled. They felt like he had not broken the law, and so that he should have an opportunity to finish his term. But we did win the Senate. But then after redistricting, we lost the Senate. And so we're up now to try to take the Senate back. But so it's been a long battle for the last almost 3 years.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with State Senator Lena Taylor from Wisconsin. Senator, what's the relationship with the governor today?
It's still strained, but you know, one of the things that I've tried to do is to have conversation, to be engaged, because they are in control, and you know, the reality is if we're going to get something done, we're going to have to work together. And even in those most divisive times, about 92% of the bills were bipartisan. So, you know, clearly most things are bipartisan. But it still is very difficult because we've seen regressive actions for women's health. We've seen regressive actions for voters' rights. We've seen regressive actions for workers. We've seen opportunities for individuals to petition their government and to be able to use the capital. All of these things we're going backwards instead of moving forward. So it's been challenging. And it's my understanding he wants to be your president or vice president or something or another. And so, God forbid.
The public sees a federal government in Congress that is divided. The perception is there is no compromise. How do you feel that is on the state level?
I'm hoping that on the state level that we can show the ability of individuals to work across party lines. But I will tell you, as someone who's tried, it's difficult. It is challenging, especially when individuals don't feel like they have to listen to you, when they don't feel like they need to compromise, when they don't really care whether or not they're found trying. So that can make it challenging. But I believe that that's what Americans want. They are tired of us just fighting. It makes no sense for Congress to just be a do-nothing Congress. You know, we have to sit down at the table and try to find places where we can work. And so at the state level, I believe it's necessary. If D.C. is going to be, you know, not functioning and not able to work together, then it really is going to be among the states. I just left a conference with the National Conference of State Legislators, and that's exactly what we were talking about.
What are the key issues that you face as a state senator in Wisconsin representing your constituents? What's most important to them these days?
Number one, jobs. We have an unemployment rate among African-American men, for example, in our community, more than 51%. You know, one of the things I shared in the story today was my dad worked a job to take care of his family. You know, I'm old-fashioned in a way, right? If you aren't able to provide for your family, if a man is not able to provide for his family as a husband, it makes for challenges. I'm a single parent. I'm the breadwinner in my family. If I'm not able to have a job that pays a decent wage and provides me with decent hours and access to health care and, you know, benefits so that I can take care of my child, it makes it very difficult for me to do anything. So that's the number one thing in my community. But I will say to you that education and criminal justice also are issues that are huge for me. Education, because only 15% of our young people between the grades of third grade and eighth grade read proficiently on their grade level. Unacceptable. If you can't read, you can't learn. You know what? 40, 50 years ago, they were fighting for us to have civil rights to be able to sit at a lunch counter. Well, now we can go to the lunch counter, but you can't read the menu. What is that? What kind of access is that? And then lastly, with the justice system, you know, in the times of Trayvon Martin and times of a state where I live in, where we lead in the nation in incarceration of African-American men and women, you know, this is really a time where we need a justice system that can show fairness, where people believe that there's fairness in that justice system. And frankly, if we have a system where the trajectory is such that incarceration is at its highest numbers, not just in the nation, but in the world, as a nation, we should want to do something differently, as well as it's costly. We spend $40,000 to incarcerate an adult in Wisconsin, $100,000 to incarcerate a juvenile. That was our number one spender in our previous budget. If that's what we're spending our money on, then we're not going to have money for education. We're not going to have money for job training. We're not going to have the dollars so that we can make sure that workers can have access. Those are my issues.
How do you solve that problem of spending that much money for that purpose?
Well, a couple of things. I think we have to realize that punitive solutions are not the only way to go. Being tough on crime is not the only option. We need to be smart on crime. We need to take best practices that exist, and we need to utilize those best practices. We need to use data-driven strategies, and we need to use communities to be engaged to help turn people around and to help show them the support that they need so that they can be on a different track. Right now, lock them up, throw away the key is the philosophy that a lot of people believe, including some of my colleagues on the same side and across the aisle, in my state and across the nation. We've got to think differently about that. And when we do, I know that we'll see that we can get different results. I mean, they've done it in places like Texas and Kansas. It can be done.
Do you think there's a connection between the education problem and the criminal justice problem?
Oh, no question. No question. You know, I always say, you know, first you learn to read and then you read to learn. If we are failing our young people at the place of being able to get that foundation that they need to be able to read, it's going to mean that the cycle of which direction they go in is not going to, you know, be a hard one to figure out. We also can see the pipeline between suspensions and individuals ultimately going into the correction system. You know, so I think we have to rethink how we deal with justice issues. Everyone doesn't need to go to prison. There are community correction opportunities and options that I think we should take advantage of. Now, don't get me wrong. Some people need to be locked up for a long time. But we need to figure out for people who have nonviolent offenses, alcohol and drug addiction issues, how to do things differently. Our war on drugs, we're losing it. It's not working. And we need to think about doing those things differently.
You're seeing that at the federal level as well with recent changes to the mandatory minimums set forth by the Attorney General. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it was a long time coming and it took too long to get here. And I'm glad that we're there, but there's a lot more to do. I frankly, you know, have question with the war on drugs, the way that we are doing, the amount of money that we're spending when policing is such on areas of nonviolent offenses and prosecution and sentencing is such that we're spending the kinds of dollars that we are on issues that we could spend significantly less. I'm glad to see the Attorney General move in a different direction. But there's so much more that I think that can happen from the federal level, including, and I was glad to see us do some changes federally related to powder and crack cocaine. But some of the same things have to happen in regards to how we deal with marijuana, how we deal with other, just many other issues. When I was at an Aspen Institute training, one of the things that one individual spoke about is just really the cost of life with the whole war on drugs, period. So I believe that it's time for us to do something different. And I believe if we patchwork it from state to state, it'll be the long way to go. It can happen that way. But I really wish we had leadership at the national level to say, we're spending too much money on this in this way, and it's not effective. We can spend our dollars more effectively.
Shifting gears for a minute, as you know, at the federal level, federal employees have been significantly impacted by sequestration and furloughs. They're currently under a three-year pay freeze. Federal employees' health benefit program premiums continue to rise year after year. What's your analysis on the state of the federal employee and the challenges that they face every day?
It's one of the reasons why I came to this particular conference was to motivate and encourage them to be engaged. They have to speak up. And they have to speak up for what is right, and for them to have access to the same values that the person who's in the 1% or the 2% has. They want to have an opportunity for their kid to go to school. They want to own a house and have a car and not have to worry about whether or not they can have health coverage to be able to take care of cancer or something else that may come their way. I think that it really is a reflection of what is happening across the nation, but the federal employee is really getting the hard brunt of it. And part of the reason is because a dysfunctional government that is not even working together, meaning Congress and the Senate and the executive branch, it means that those individuals who otherwise would be protected through those elected officials speaking on their behalf is not happening because they're not working on legislation. So I really believe that it's sad to see those individuals who take care of our veterans. They're the same individuals who have to go home and have the kind of concerns and worries, you know, that you spoke about.
And you see them many times being thrown into the political conversation, almost as if they're a political football.
And it's unfair because in the end, they're doing a service for this nation. The postperson doing a service for this nation. Those individuals who are serving our veterans or in healthcare, are serving in Social Security, are serving in IRS, are serving. And so the issue is, why should they be kicked in the teeth, so to say, and kicking them when they're down, you know, versus helping to build them up and appreciating the service that they give, I think is also not only an important piece, I think it's our duty. I think it's our duty. And so it's a sad place that we're at, that the American dream is slowly but surely not necessarily being accessible for everyone. That's really what it's about.
As we close out here today, what's your focus going to be carrying through the rest of the summer into the fall and then to close out the rest of the year?
Well, one of the things that we are doing right now in Wisconsin is we're working on an effort to win back the state Senate. So spending some energy on that surely is something that's important. But also there's been a rash of violence in our community. And so trying to do things to mobilize people in our community to be engaged is something that we'll be working on. And then I've been trying to do something that takes a little more effort. It's building some relationships and trying to work across the aisle.
State Senator Lena Taylor from Wisconsin. Senator, great to have you here today. Thanks for coming by and spending some time with us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, AFGE Housing and Urban Development Council 222 President Eddie Eiches will take us inside negotiations with HUD Management to reduce furlough days.